I want to do something a little different today. I want to talk about Yom Kippur. But before I go into Yom Kippur, I want to talk a little bit about some of the things that I'm going to be talking about tonight in class, about psychology in our mind and our brain. Because a lot of the times we look at Yom Kippur from one facet, and there's a lot that we can learn from another facet sort of brings it all together. So I want to start with a man named Robert Rosenthal. Robert Rosenthal was a professor at Harvard, and in 1968 he had an idea. He had a theory he had been developing, but he wanted to try it out. He went to a school called the Oak Tree School. And in the Oak Tree School, what he did was he gave a test to all these students. It was a fake test. It was like a placebo test. But what he did was, after the test was done, he walked into the classrooms of the teachers of these students, and he randomly selected some students. He just made the whole thing up. He just picked a couple of kids that it had. And he told the teachers, by the way, these kids in your classroom, you didn't realize it, they have unique intellectual abilities. They're going to be blooming now. They're coming, and they're reaching, they're above and beyond intellectually what the other kids are. He made the whole thing. He's from Harvard, he can do stuff like this. He made it all up, and he's like, really? And he's like, I'm from Harvard. And they're like, oh. And these teachers were like, oh my gosh. Then he books out for a year, messes with their minds and books out for a year, all in the name of science. Comes back at the end of the year, and he goes, give me the test scores of these kids. Looks at the entire class. He's done something very interesting. He knows that the top kids, all the English kids are these kids. He goes, give me the math scores. English is subjective. The teachers are doing some notes. They realize what add-ons in this essay, but Harvard got these smart babies. Me, math, either you know or you don't. Top eight kids were these kids. It was random. They weren't even what? He goes, gives the kid an IQ test. And he says to them, I remember IQ test when you're little. You take IQ test, they give you blocks, and I tell your mom, like, okay, maybe they'll be an athlete. You know what I'm saying? Like, maybe it'll give up son. Okay, maybe the doctor in him. You know what I'm saying? At least that was my experience. Right? So the IQ test is supposed to tell you how smart you can be for the rest of your life, whether or not you can play blocks when you're 2 years old. He gives the kid the IQ test. And these kids perform between 3 and 5 points better in a year. And at that moment, something in the world of psychology was born. It's called the Rosenthal effect, or the Pygmalion effect. And the Pygmalion effect is that you think that we live in a world where our reality shapes our beliefs. How smart you are is how you'll perform. This is what you got. You get what you get, and you don't get upset. And so that's what you should be thinking about as you think of what you're doing next in your life. But it's actually reversed. In truth, beliefs shape reality. It's based on a Greek myth from Pygmalion. Pygmalion was a sculptor. He sculpted out a sculpture of a beautiful woman and fell in love with her and went around to the entire world to find her. And there was nobody as beautiful as what he sculpted out. And the Greek gods felt for him. And he cried and he davened or whatever. And they gave him a mace. And she turned into a human being. And she was called Pygmalion. And the idea is that that in which you believe has an effect on what reality is. Now, this caused a huge stir in 1968, and as a result, there's been a meeting. I'll just show you a couple of studies to get the power of this. There's a woman named Ellen Lane, another professor in Harvard. She's an amazing woman. She's actually the first ever tenured woman in the psychology department in Harvard. She was number one. She did amazing studies. She said, okay, I really believe this concept that beliefs shape your reality, but how far does this go? It could affect how you perform. It could affect what you do. It could affect how you sit and take a test. But it can really affect your mind, your body. Can it have an effect in things that you're not even paying attention to? So what she did was she took two groups of people, two men. One group, they're all 80-year-old men. She took one group of 80-year-old men, she put them in a hotel, and it was a throwback week. They sat back, they remember the good old days, times when nobody stole, and all the politicians were fair, and all the good stuff, and there was no internet, all the kids paid attention, everyone was religious. They sat back, and they looked, and they reminisced about the good old days, 20 years old years, for a full month. Then she took another group of 80-year-olds, and she put them in a different hotel, smaller hotel, boutique hotel. She remodeled the whole hotel. And what she did was she had that hotel be literally 20 years earlier. When you walked in, you were in a time warp. The wallpaper was 20 years. The TV had a little tiny circle, a black box, and had like Dick Van Dyke on it. And whatever the Time magazine was on, they were talking about politics, about Nixon, everything. And you weren't allowed to speak about the past. The only rule was, everything has to be in the present. You have to act as if you're 20 years younger. She comes back here for a month, and she tests them for every single age-related symptoms. Vision, joint dexterity, arthritis, memory, everything that goes with age. And for those people that were in the, remember the good old days, hotels, there was no shit. But for those people that are actually living 20 years younger, every sign of aging reversed. She took pictures of them. They looked like they were 20. They looked different. Their arthritis changed. Everything about them, their bodies physically changed. Because it's something that we have. The power of our minds, and that power is so powerful that we live in a world sometimes, and we're looking at our worlds and we're saying, my reality is what's going to shape what's possible for myself, for my career, for my children, for my marriage. And science says, not so much. Here's what I'm going to take two more slides, we're going to move on. This stuff is powerful stuff. She took a bunch of chambermaids. She went out and she went to a hotel and she took chambermaids and she asked them, anyone here work out? And they're like, no, we work out. I mean, we wake up early in the morning, we work all day, we come back, we don't have money to live. She goes, that's so terrible for you. Splits them in half. One room, she says, you know what? It's so terrible. I'm so sorry. It is what it is. These are the cries of adults. Good luck. They go back to work. Another room, she says, you don't work out? Are you crazy? You don't work out? Making a bed. 500 calories. Vacuuming. Come on, your whole life is working out. And they go, really? She goes, yeah, look at what you do every day. You have a better work than those people that go into the gym. Then she leaves them alone for a month. Comes back. Everyone's doing the same thing. Everyone's doing the same. No one shifts it. She goes, anyone shift your diet? No. Anyone shift your activities? No. Everyone from both groups are doing the same thing all day? Yes. So then she weighs group number one, no change. Body, nothing. Then she weighs group number two. They're doing the exact same thing. They lost weight, their body shifts, the whole body changes. Because their mind's saying, I'm losing weight. And the body follows. She took a bunch of people on it. Remember those eye tests that we did? Remember a little kid when you didn't want to get glasses, so like you lied on the eye test? You ever do this? You know? You can read it, and it's like, you're like, A, B, C, D. The guy's like, nah, you know what I'm saying? Like, she took the people and she waited for that line. And then she figured out the people from that line. And wherever can't read that bottom line, she pulled them out of a room and put them in a separate room. And she took them through an experiment. She goes, the U.S. Army wants to do an experiment on pilots. Do you mind being part of it? They're like, yeah. What am I going to do? They're like, if the right pilot uniforms in a cockpit of an F-16, they're like, yes, I'm signing up for this. She sits them in a pilot. What do pilots have? Amazing vision. Sits them in a pilot uniform. Same people. Can't read the line. And when you're sitting by the doctor and it all goes down, the same person is now over here sitting in a pilot's uniform. Ellen Langer, check it out from her. A pilot uniform and an F-16. She goes, oh, by the way, there's a plane next door. Do you mind just reading the ID number of the plane, the exact same size as what they couldn't read a minute ago on the eye test? And one by one, they all picked it off. Why? Because what's happening is that for most of us, we live a life where we are assuming that we've got what we've got, and I'm going to make my decisions of my reality based on what I think I have currently. My beliefs follow my reality. And it's actually the exact opposite. In reality, beliefs shape reality, not the other way around. I'll tell you one more story, then we're going to move on. This is great. Anyone here named Roger Bannister? Anyone here Roger Bannister?
Foreman Watt.
Roger Bannister, 1954, did the one thing that nobody thought any human could do. Roger Bannister was a medical student at the University of Oxford. And at that point, nobody in the history of the world ever broke a mile, never ran a mile in less than 4 minutes. Nobody. And Roger Bannister's medical student said, why can't we do it? And the doc said, do it. Do me a favor. Relax. Calm down, young guy. You can't run a mile less than 4 minutes. You know why? Because your bodies aren't built this way. We're not animals. Your lungs are going to collapse. As they told Henry Ford, by the way, if a human being goes 30 miles an hour, they told Henry Ford that their lungs are going to collapse back then. He said, you can't do it. Your mind, the way your bone structure is and your feet, the way your lungs are, it's impossible. He goes, impossible. 1954, in front of a packed capacity crowd in Oxford, Roger Bannister breaks the record in 3:59. Next day, headlines, signs defied. This is where it gets awesome. Next year, 1955, how many runners broke the 4 minute mile? Now, they've been running from the beginning. They haven't stopped running. They didn't run slow until Bannister showed them, like, oh, let me just step it up, put it into fifth gear. 55 runners. The next year, I said to them, they ran fast the year before. What's going on? The next year after that, 1956, 350 runners. All the guys basically out there that could never break the 4 minute mile, within 2 years, everyone breaks it. How come? So here's what happens. Here's what's going on. This is what I want to talk a little bit about today. I know we don't have that much time. Just for a few minutes. When we spoke about this on Yom Div. The way it works is that every single one of us has a mind. But here's what's going on. And I'll tell you the story. Remember when I got I had my son first, and then I had identical twin girls. So I went from 1 to 3 overnight, like instant family. So we had a conversation that I never wanted to have really early in life. The minivan conversation. Right? So my wife comes home, like, Miles, everyone's wonderful. She looks at me, and she gives me that look. I'm like, no minivan, right? So she said, why not? I said, listen, I would totally be the minivan guy, but I've never in my life seen a guy in his 20s in a minivan. I don't want to be the first. I don't want to be the second. I don't want to be the third. But, like, I can't recall any moment ever in my life of seeing a man in a minivan. I just don't want to be number one. So my wife, she's like, sure, Mom. Yeah, whatever you need. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Let's go to the leasing shop. We go to the leasing dealership. And then in 2 minutes, I don't know how this is happening, I'm picking between silver and black. And I'm like, black and silver, I won't buy. Wait a second, how did I agree to this? But that's how it works. The best negotiators of all time. So I'm sitting down picking, I'm like, you know what, fine, you win. Okay, I'll get a minivan. I think I want a minivan. I like it. The cup holders, there's 500 cup holders. I like to be on the floor. I like the doors open and closed. I'm in. I love it. I don't really care for it. I actually want a minivan. Here's the deal. I don't drive it in the neighborhood. We live in Queens. I got to keep a track of my masculinity. You want to go on a road trip, we pop on the bed. I'll go forever. We'll go to Boston, we'll go to Florida. In the neighborhood, let's keep, no problem. Get home that night, I'm already riding around doing errands in the neighborhood. And I pull up next to, I'll never forget this my whole life, I pull up next to a guy. And I had this bad habit of when a red light is, you want to get to the first. You know, you can't stand, especially if it's a minivan, you can't get behind the minivan. You don't know how long. So you want to be the first guy at the light. So you can pop right in. I look over, there's a minivan in front of me. And as I pull up to the red light, I pull over, and there's a guy my age at the front. I'm like, oh my God, second ever guy in the world in a minivan, and me at the same red light. I'm like, He's like, what? Who is that? He's like, I'm like, hey! He's like, hello. I'm like, nice minivan. And like, the window's like, don't look. And I go, I'm like, oh my God, there was another guy in the minivan. And I was like, yeah. I have to live with you and put up with this stuff. But the truth, I had never seen it before. No, really, I had never, ever seen a man in a minivan. How come? So the way it works in reality is that our minds have a very limited scope of what can be considered reality. There's a huge reality out there in the world, but that's irrelevant to us. What goes on in Bangladesh, what's going on in Israel right now, what's happening in every other law firm or every other country, that's not part of reality. That could be out there, but our reality, our life, only can process that in which fits into our scope. In science, it's called a schema. That's all we got. We have 110 bits of information that we can get in per second. That's it. When we take in the world, the only thing that becomes part of my reality is that in which I have space for. Which is why, if I'm talking right now, and you're talking to somebody else, you can't do conversations because we don't have it. You need about 60 to 70 bits of information per second per conversation, and you can't do it enough. So as we go into the world, the only thing that we have that is reality is that in which my schema can take in. If I can't take it in, it's not real. It may be for somebody else, but in the essence of reality, it doesn't exist. If the tree falls in the forest, in my life, it doesn't exist. It may exist somebody else once I learn about it later on, if I see it or hear about it. But if it falls right now, as I'm sitting with you, in my reality, it doesn't exist. The only reality that I have is that in which I can process. Now watch what happens. I'm only processing that which I can process, but what's designing and what's determining my process mechanism? My belief. I set the filter. And when my filter set a certain way, I look out into the world. I had never seen a minivan in my life. I wasn't lying. You know why? Because until I had two girls and three kids, that was never even in my bailiwick. I never would stop. It probably passed me a million times. But it never registered. So it probably flipped right out of my life. In my reality, it didn't exist. There's a famous thing in science, and there's also in the medical world, it's called the placebo effect. That your body has certain natural healing powers, but you can't tap into it. So what do? So you come to the doctor. There's a great scientist named Benson. Herbert Benson did a lot of this stuff. You ever hear the study they did with the ladies with it? They had ladies that were pregnant. They came in for nausea. And he gave them medicine that would reduce nausea. And he wanted to play with them a little bit. And then he gave them placebos. And he found that most of them were okay. And then he gave a medicine called Ipecac. You know, Ipecac induces vomiting. When some God forbid, a kid swallows stuff that's not, if anyone swallows poison, they go to the hospital, give them Ipecac. So he took a medicine in the shape of medicine that's anti-nausea, and it was Ipecac. The chemicals of the medicine were designed to make them vomit more. And he gave it to them. And found that for the majority of them, they were fine. The placebo effect happens every day of the year. Every day of the week, someone's giving somebody a placebo. Why? Because our bodies, our minds, are taking information. We have power inside, we just can't access because our mind's saying, don't access it. You can't, you need this, you need this, you need this, you need it. All of a sudden, you take it, it's a water pill, and your body can respond a certain way. All of a sudden, you look out, you see a minivan, like, I had never seen one before. You ever play the game Spot the Jew? You know the game Spot the Jew? You know what I'm talking about? Let me see that old man shoot the baseball cap, and you're like, really? You're really hiding? Do me a favor. And you know what I'm talking about? I remember one time I took a guy, I don't know if it was in Davis Park, I was in some law firm, I think it was Paul Weiss, and I took out a client. It was a non-Jewish guy at the Yankee game. We had closed some deal. We went out to the Yankee game. And I wanted to dab a mincha. So I see some guy, typical Orthodox Jewish attire, Yankee Stadium, slacks, blue shirt, and a baseball cap, hiding. You know what I'm talking about? So he's passing by me, and I look at him and go, hey. He's like, hello. I'm like, hi. He goes, who are you? I'm like, what time is mincha? He goes, what about me says mincha? I'm like, everything about you says mincha. Are you joking me? You think you put on a baseball cap and you hide? You don't think you know that's a wig? Like, for real? You play slot the wig? You don't see the bump? Are you kidding me? You know what I'm talking about? Like, and you see someone like, that's a wig? That's not her hair? And you're like, what? You think that's her hair? How is it possible? I have a friend of mine who's Asian. I'll never forget, we're in the Lower East Side once, and we played the game together. I went to the Lower East Side, I'm like, picking Jews out. He's like, how do you know? We went into Chinatown. I'm like, I can't tell the difference. He's like, what do you mean? It's like 1,000 different times. How is it possible? It's because your mind has been able to register so many types of Jews if you live in an Orthodox community that you can look at someone and go, I know that the obvious one is being hidden under the baseball cap, but there's so much about you that I can't even understand how I'm doing this, but then I can pick this out and say, you're one of us, or whatever, I'm not saying one better than the other, but you're this, or you're that. I can pick out that although someone looks bad and goes, it's impossible, it's like hair, because my half of my closet is filled with this stuff, I can pick out, actually, even how expensive they are, it's a different story. This, by the way, is a concept, if anyone has read the book by Malcolm Gladwell, he popularized this concept from a neuroscientist named Daniel Levitin called the 10,000-hour rule. Some of you have heard of this, the 10,000-hour rule, where being an expert in something requires 10,000 hours. Why? Because your brain is creating a filter, a scheme that is so precise that when you're, that's why I think it takes a long time to become a partner, to become a, because you have to be able to walk into something and go, I've seen this a million times before. This just feels right and wrong. We're doing this. And I go, how did you know to do this? Like, I'm looking at a situation, I'm looking at a deal, I'm looking at a patient, I'm looking at my job, but it just, this is, let's go this way. How do you know more than the person next to you? Because you've seen it a million times. Your schema, your filter is focused on it, and when you put in information, you get a certain result. The way life works is that your beliefs, your mind, your schema has a large impact on your reality than what your reality has on your mind. Your marriage is based more on your schema than whether or not that person was a right or wrong catch. Your kid's success is based more on your schema than whether or not the kid was smarter or not as smart, popular or not as popular, good at sports or not, all that nonsense that we kill our kids with. His or her success in life is based much more on how you view them than how they are created. Even if they're created with special needs. Because you see, everyone who knows anything about special needs, you know, there are special needs kids that are broken and special needs kids that are flying. And it has nothing to do with who they are, it has to do with how they're treated. Your job is your schema. How you treat people. This is all the time. Your life is your schema. It's not outside in. We're looking into this period of time, you know what we're doing? We're looking up at God and we're going, can you give me some more stuff for God's sake? Like, hello, like, I'm here, I'm saying words, like, isn't this like an on this since Black Friday for Jews? Like, I'm clicking, words, give me. If I would just have a little more money or this, and my wife would say, my kids, can someone give me more stuff from the outside? And God's going, no, I'm sorry. It's not the outside. This, what's causing this whole I need more in life stuff is not anywhere there. It's right here. You're not getting it. The scheme is not there. You're looking at something and you're like, oh, that's the person. Post off. You're a Yankee fan. The Yankees lose, you fit. It doesn't matter. It's the game. It's your perception of the game, not the game itself. So how does this apply to Yom Kippur? This, I believe, is the essence of Yom Kippur. Because what is Yom Kippur? So I grew up, here's how I learned it. Basically, it's a day of torture that you have to go through because you're a Jew. This we do. We just torture ourselves. Everyone else's New Year's is margaritas. Our New Year's is 40 days of I'm sorry, followed by 2 days of I'm sorry, then another 10 days of I'm sorry, then 25-hour fast of, yeah, I'm sorry. And when you're done almost fainting and saying, I'm sorry, and what happens, the rabbi gets up and goes, it's almost over. The gates are closing. Don't forget to say, I'm sorry. And why do we do this for? Because when we were kids, they told us somehow that like if you don't say I'm sorry, then the big bad God comes in and starts zapping you with bad ears, and the whole thing gets messed up. Here's the deal: if you know it, you don't know it. Stay in line, do your thing. It's almost over. The circus will be here in a minute. You know what I'm saying? Like, just not say I'm sorry. Go through the motions. Otherwise, you can get a bad ear. He's giving out goodies now. This is it. The store is open. Take advantage. The store is open. Your year is for you. Scream. It's like spiritual color war. Scream louder. Can I hear you, blue team? Scream louder. Louder. Can you get louder? I don't know. Louder. These are just robotic words. Just keep on screaming. Isn't that what this is? Just show up. Put your head down and scream. And then hopefully, if you scream loud enough, and like we were able to get through the guilt in some way, and like somehow get through this, then at the end we go, oh, we got a good year. And then if something bad happens in the year, we're like, oh, did I mess this whole thing up? Did you ever hear this, by the way? Someone got up and get sick. You must have not had a good Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Like as if like you didn't order it right, you didn't fill out the order form at the end, and like something went wrong. Did you not have a good Rosh Hashanah because you got sick for it? The guy died, why? Must have been the Elah. Yeah. They didn't have a good enough for Eli. I think that's what happened to him in February. That's what I heard. I don't know. We buy this stuff. It's like amazing. So we show up. We don't say anything. We don't look to the left. We don't look to the right. Just keep on focused. Don't say anything. And nod this way through. That's God. The creator of humanity. He's got nothing better to do than torture a couple of his kids once a year. And then like expect, as if like he's holding like blessing. Like he's got all this money right here. And he's like, can you get louder? Can you get louder? Sorry, guys. Oh, wait, how about here? Rayman's in the house. I'm sprinkling dollar bills on that thing. You know what I'm saying? That's what God's doing. I was gonna zap you and make you sick, but okay, fine. You said some words here. I'm going to make you healthy. And we buy this, and we digest this, and we just go through it. Keep our heads down. Stay as much as robotic as I... And then, best night of the year, anybody? Motzi Yom Kippur. Why? It's the largest part, the longest part of the calendar to the next Yom Kippur. Best night. That bagel, Motzi Yom Kippur, you're like, wow. I got a year till I do this again. This is great. I remember when I was growing up, what's the best month for a basketball fan? March. Just the sound of March makes me feel like it's going to be madness. For a Jew, Elul, I've never heard. You Rosh Chodesh Elul. I go, yes. It's about time. I mean, this year we had a summer. Thank God. No Labor Day. We get to cut right into this stuff. We're like playing games. It's like we're going through the motions, hoping God doesn't see. It's like a game that we play. What's going on? What's the purpose of Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur? It has everything to do with one thing, in my opinion. Schema. We're living in a world where we are outside in. How we process the stimulus of the outside world is how we live our lives. Beliefs shape reality. Perception allows us to miss things that are invisible. You can speak to someone, they're like, I said good morning to you, how come you didn't say how you doing? You go, what do you mean? I just said good morning back. And she looks at you, if she's related to you, or if you're friends with her, and she goes, had you been my friend, you would have looked in my eyes, you would have said, I know it's not a good morning. It was invisible to me, but it was visible to them. Perception has things be invisible to us. The minivans go right past us. They're not real. Meanwhile, they're so real. If it works outside in, that means it works inside out. The way it really works. That we live a life where we think is that God is separate from us. He's somewhere up in heaven. Somehow he's in some big throne, and it could be huge. It's like somewhere like above the universe somewhere, and he's invisible, like as if like I could put a string around him and he is something out there, and he looks down, and he knows if we're good and if we're not familiar, and he knows if you're naughty or if you're nice, and if you're nice, he gives you presents, not on the 25th of December, he just gives it to you, in September, and he knows how you are. That's how we think of God, that he's up there. In truth, that's not true at all. The way it really works is that God's not up there. There is no up there. The sky is up there. You know where God is? In here. Your experience of God is not outside you. It's within you. When God created the world, first he created angels, and that's not from the old stuff. Then he created animals. That's not from the old pay attention. So what he did was he did something amazing. Like, mind-boggling amazing. He took a human being, and he raised him on his 2 feet, and he took himself. Himself. The all, everything. The all infinite, the all divine, the all powerful, the all courageous, everything in the world that we want, he is all of it. Himself. It's not like Lego said, he doesn't lose a piece of himself. He took himself and he put it inside you. So if your eyes are open, I'm this religious, I'm not religious, I'm connected, I'm not connected, I wear this clothes, I'm that clothes, I'm part of this religion, I'm that clothes, it's all nonsense. If your eyes are open, you're being powered by the infinite. Your life is infinite. He's with you on carpool. He's with you at 2 o'clock in the morning in David's Polk. He is with you everywhere you go. He is within you. You never have to be something. You have to reveal something. You never have to ask on the outside for things. Everything you need is already on the inside. It's the ultimate fake out. He is never anywhere. He is always within. Your only relationship to outside is through within. The goal of Yom Kippur is not to line up and get goodies from God. The goal of Yom Kippur is to clear away and figure out, how do I access the source that's already inside me? This is a source called Chaim, called life. This is a big mistake. We think life is physical life. We are not asking for physical life. That is the indirect benefit of what we want. We're asking for spirituality. There's something called spirituality. It's in everything. What Jews believe in, what we brought to the humanity that was completely revolutionary, is that we are the nation that brought a concept to humanity that is, spirituality is not on a mountaintop. It's in a marriage. You know where it is even? Because we're all adults. It's in the intimacy of a man and a wife. That is extremely spiritual, which is why it draws a soul from the world. We're the ones that put spirituality into food. We're the ones that put spirituality into kids. You know what we're the ones who put spirituality into? Work. It's long and it's hard and it's spiritual. It's done correctly. Not just not cheating. We brought spirituality into the world. When you bring spirituality into the world, you know what happens? It's like, that's complicated stuff. It's so much easier to be spiritual on a mountaintop. It is so much easier to say, that guy in the corner is spiritual. That guy working? Not so much. Maybe you could be this, but don't be this. We're the ones that have the task every year to make sure the world knows that spirituality is within. Your life can be infused with purpose and meaning, not when you're in the ilah, when you're in work, not when you're sitting by a rabbi, when you're sitting with your kid, when you're talking to your wife. When that becomes purposeful, you are living what's called chayim. When every second of your life is not stressed, is not worried, is not what's going to be, when every second of your life has a certain glisten of there is purpose, there is spirituality to everything, when I wake up in the morning and I can feel something, because you can sense the soul if you're adept to, when I can feel a certain bounce in my step, when I can connect to a source that's deeper than me, my life is life. More money, less money, more bracha, less money, that's all wonderful. But it's not worth anything if you can't live it. You can have all the money in the world. We all know people that have all the money in the world, and the world may be miserable. Stuff isn't worth it if you can't put it into a kli, into a vessel called spirituality. Who we are is a soul. What we have is a body. And we have a career, and we've got kids, and we've got a resume, and we're very impressive, and we talk to each other. But who we are is a soul. And our ability to connect to that and bring it to our lives is what Chayim is. It's not a book that we get into that has all these properties and you get to go somewhere and you get stuff. It's a way of life that you buy into because you decide to. But how do you get there? Schema. It's all schema. You know, one of the greatest Kabbalistic things ever said I found is that God never kicked Adam out of the Garden of Eden. Adam kicked God out of the Garden of Eden. We are actually living in what is called the Garden of Eden. We just don't have God. We don't have spirituality, so we beat each other up and compete, and that's the way it looks. There's no Garden of Eden. We don't like magically go into like a paradise with like waterfalls. It's just how you live your life here, at every moment, at every second. You decide just what play and what role your soul has in everything. But how do we do this? So hard. It's so much easier on a mountaintop. I mean, like, I gotta live. I gotta get up in the morning. It's traffic. I got work. I got 400 assignments before I get to Yom Kippur. My kid is screaming. Me and my wife are having an argument. How do I live this way? So I remember years ago, I started dieting. It took me a long time. I used to, really about 5-6 years ago, I really started getting into dieting. I remember the first time I get into a diet. Remember that whole thing where, like, you go to the gym for the first time, right? You're riding on a treadmill. And like you're jogging for like 40 minutes, you're like 15 seconds, you have to, like, time slows down and like space around treadmills, which never goes. And I remember the beginning, I was like trying and trying, I couldn't. And then finally, after trying this for 2 years, 3 years, I realized that there's like stuff going on there. It's not just like the way, it's not just eating a hamburger, it really isn't good for you. And there's like a whole world of like carbs, and you don't mix carbs and you don't mix fat. And you work out these muscles and that muscles, and there's the Atkins theory, and there's this theory and that theory. And what happens is, after a while, if you really get into it, and there's veganism, which is a whole new world of what meat does to you. But if you really do it and do it and do it, you wake up one morning, you know what happens? You stop dieting. You just start being healthy. Something happens to you when you diet. There's two types of people. There's people that say, I want to diet, which means pass me more dessert and I have less kilt on Yom Tov. And then after you get to your fourth or sixth, tomorrow I'm going to diet. And then some people that are like just dieting and dieting, and they wake up one morning like, you know what? I don't even want this. I come to the room, I'm not eating those fries, that's just not who I am. The identity shifts. When your identity shifts, you know what shifts with it? Your schema. You see the world differently. You're not fighting the diet. You're healthy. You may fall. This is who I am. I walk in, I see the world differently. I come to the restaurant, I see the world differently. I watch somebody eat that, and I'm literally, physically disgusted. How? 2 weeks ago, that was me. Or 2 years ago. Schema. Just your mind. You made a decision, you identified with something, and then you look at the exact same world, and now you're totally different. When you pull away from it, after a while, you realize, holy cow, this is who I am. So watch what happens. We're souls. The Garden of Eden is in front of us. Our life is fine. Some of us may have crisis, but for most of us, the reason we're not flying with life right now is because of our mind. Our marriage isn't amazing because of our mind. It's our stuff. It's our nonsense. Our kids aren't flying because of our stuff. Okay, there could be other issues, but for the most part, I don't love my job because it's still about me. And when my boss can realize how smart I am and when they can give me a promotion and not about the clients I'm supposed to service. The world that I see is still so unfair because I don't process it in a certain way. I don't live with the spirituality, I live with the physical. So what God does is, because here's the story. One day a year, here's what we're going to do. We're going to clean that filter. One day a year. I can't think of more years of breakdown. One day a year, we're cleaning the filter. Urges, how much of our society is based on one thing, biological urges? How much of our world is based on urges, desires, billboards? Everywhere you look, we're like at our needs. Industries are built on playing to our desires. One day a year, God goes, no tashmish, intimacy, no desires, connect, enough. How much of our lives are based on comfort? Just comfort. Because everything that you need, if you have it more than twice, is now, everything you thought was going to be amazing is now needed. If you ever fly first class more than twice, it's disastrous. Because then either you're going to fly for the rest of your life first class, or you got to go back to coach. As soon as you fly first class twice, you're like, I can't sit. Sit with them. I can't. I gotta wait in line. Look how small the seats are. I don't get coffee before the plane takes off. I'm a human being, for God's sakes. Comfort. I know I had a Shabbos meal a few weeks ago. God bless this woman. She's wonderful. Everything. She should have everything well. Half the meal was how she needed a new kitchen. And she should have a new kitchen. I need it. I've got 3 kids. I have a house. Like, how do you have a kitchen? How do you raise children without an eating kitchen, 2 sinks, and granite countertops? Like, I'm like barely surviving. I'm like, Nebuch, I'm so sorry for you. Remember when I was in RXR? It was in 08. We had a little bump in the economic world. At the Orthodox, I'm like a half like priest confession guy, also, which is fun to be. So I remember one guy comes in, he goes, Charlie, I talked to you, he said, what's the matter? Because I had a terrible week. No, what's the matter? He goes, I had to give him my yacht this week. I'm like, Bobby, I'm so sorry. He goes, finally, somebody understands me. I'm like, understand you, 2,000 men don't have a job. Are you crazy? You don't need a yacht? He's like, but I'm the only one in the country without a yacht. This guy's done so well for himself. Comforts, our life, for the most part, again, I'm not saying everybody, most part, we're just playing for comfort right now. Our grandparents played for survival. We're playing for levels of comfort. You know what the symbol of comfort is in Judaism? Shoes. Because the only article of clothing you wear that has really very little basis except for the fact that it keeps you comfortable from the ground. It is what blocks us at every pace from the hard, sandy, rocky floor. God goes, you know what? I got it. Need the kitchen. I got it. Need the weight. Daddy, I need the weight. Okay? One day a year, no comforts. You know what we care about a lot? You know what our body loves? How we look. Oh, how it looks. How we look. How's it going to look? I have this job. I don't have this job anymore. You know how it looks? You know how it's going to look? If he doesn't have, you know how it's going to look? If you don't go here? If I don't go to this school, you know how it's going to look? If we don't do this, you know how it's going to look? I was once, now, do you know how it looks? I spend all my day worried about how I look. God goes, no cosmetics. You know what? I like how you look. One day a year. You know what? I like how you look the way you look. Don't put anything on. Don't make yourself up. Don't trust you. Schema. Schema. Clear the filter. Clear the filter. One day a year. One day a year, God goes, you know what? Let's go further. You're worried about your survival. You're worried about your body. It's important. Health is important. Forget it. It's still just your body. I got it. It's important, but it's still not you. Eating and drinking. Basic survival. Get rid of it. One day a year, we stand before God, and all we do is see the world from a clear filter. We spend one day a year. Okay, we'll eat later. It's like our whole lives are like, can I eat enough? Like the one bagel that we break our fast and like gets in the way of this. But one day a year, all that pressure, all the running, all the being, all the who I am, all am I going to make it, all am I going to be it, all my, has everybody see me, all do I have enough money, all am I going to survive, my kids going to be held, all of that stuff that has sucked away our life, that has made my marriage mean ochre because I'm running to work here, that has made, my kids don't really know me. They know me, but they don't know me. They don't know how much I love them. My family, I'm still holding a grudge. My sister-in-law, I'm still holding grudges, for God's sake. My grandparents are old. I call them like once every month. I'm going to regret that. You know, 2 years ago, I had an idea for this community. I was going to do it. And then I said, after this deal closes, and after this business closes, and remember I was supposed to be somebody? Remember those days? Remember when I was a dreamer? Remember when I was me? One day a year, God says, clear the filters. I got your report. Clear the filters. It's all schema. It's all your beliefs. That's all this is. It's just beliefs. The beliefs are what's shaping your reality. It's Pygmalion. It's Rosenthal. It's Roger Bannister. It's a placebo. It's all what you're thinking it is. You're lost. One day, you sit back one day, and you have one day off from your body. And you spend the day going, where have I been? You know what happens if you're doing it right? Yo, man, I messed that up. That was all about me. Holy cow, I am sorry about that. And you know, I messed that one up too. You know, I've been about me my whole life. This has all been about this whole, my filter is like black. And you stand before your creator who's inside you, not outside you, and go, I'm off. Now, as the minivan passes me, I realize it's a minivan. That is my job. That is my family. That's why I joined my career in the first place 20 years ago. I wanted to do something. I've been worrying about my promotion, not my clients. I've been worrying about myself, not my friends. I say I can't sit and learn. It's an excuse. I can sit in front of a contract for 2 years. I just can't sit for 2 minutes because it's got to be about me. I haven't sat. I'm a fruit Jew. I've been going to shul for 30, 40, 50 years. I don't even know what I'm saying. I'm making stuff up. I'm just reciting Greek. I'm hoping there's no tachanun today. Because then I get 3 minutes open. Because Monday and Thursday, oh my God. Best day of the year. You come back into Yom Kippur and there's no tachanun for that whole week. You look around to show people like jumping off the chairs. No tachanun. The month of Nisan, best month of the year by far. I'm faking it. Like I got it out there, but I'm totally faking it. I'm just saying stuff. Am I going to say stuff my whole life? Am I going to give back? I said I'd give back. I'm gonna pitch to YU. Just want to throw that in. Am I gonna give back? Because I said I would. I want to be the guy that gives, but I'm never the guy with the open hand and stuff. There's always my friend who has got the open hand. I'm always the guy that's pulling back a little bit. I'm always the guy that's writing the check for a little less. I want to be the guy that writes the check for a little bit more. I want to be that guy. Filters. Best day of the year. Mishnah and Yuma. Loya Yom Tovim Ki Yisrael Ki Chamishas Av. The Tanoim say, do me a favor, you'll have your bagel. One day a year, it's just you. Best day of the year. Just be you. And on Yom Kippur, the goal is not to kiss up, it's not to say random words. God doesn't wait for bracha. It's because our kli sometimes isn't ready for bracha. You can't just, if you give a spoiled kid too much stuff, it becomes worse. You get a kid who understands what he's doing and things, and you're a parent, you give him everything. Sometimes we're not trying to change God. We never change God. When you dive in, you're never changing God. What you're doing is by asking for something, you're changing yourself. And by changing yourself, now God, who's already flowing in, can open up a new place to flow in. on Yom Kippur, all that gets cleared. You stand before your Creator who's inside you and you go, I've been missing minivans all year. I just have. I don't know where they are. I'm missing them. I want to see minivans again. I've been missing opportunity after opportunity to be me. And I'm blaming everything in the world on the outside, and it's not everyone's fault. You know whose fault it is? Mine. You know how you know you're done, woman. You know how you're done? You know your yotzei vidui? This is halacha. I don't know where it's called. You know what the word is when you're yotzei vidui? You say one word, you're yotzei. If you miss this word, you're not yotzei. It's called aval anachnu. When you say, I know, especially by the Sfarim, you know, we were, you know what I'm saying? Avinu, and you say, ultimately you say, aval anachnu, avasinu yoshan. Right? When you say aval, why? Because what aval is but. And all year we're saying, yeah, but. And one year we go, aval, that but. And God's like, here we go again, here comes the excuse. Anachnu, it's me. It's been me. Truth is, it's always been me. And if we can do that, clear that filter, be Roger Bannister, what will happen is we'll realize that we can run 4 minute mile, whatever that is in our lives. We just don't want to work hard enough. We just want to crawl on the floor. We just don't want to say the things that make us feel weird to the people that we know need to hear it. I can call and say I'm sorry. I can call my mom and tell her how much I love her. I can tell my wife how I feel. I can tell my kids how much I could. I can slow it down. I can work a little less. It's fine. I can work later. I can sleep 1 hour less on the end of the world. I can do this. I can do it. I really could run the 4 minute mile. And we stand before God once a year and we go, I can see clearly now. And my bracha to you and to all of us is that we get that. You get that clarity. You clear that filter. What happens is, like Roger Bannister and Robert Rosenthal, your beliefs now shape your reality. When your mind and your soul is in the book of life, you know what happens? God doesn't put you in the book of life. You put you in the book of life. Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur is not about God's pen. Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, God gives you the pen and says, what book do you want to be into? You sit there in Yom Kippur and you go, ha. And then you leave, and because you have now the beliefs, you know what it's doing? It's shaping your reality. My bracha, my blessing to all of us is that we live a life where we are filled with clarity, that we are filled with the right beliefs, where we realize that the challenge of spirituality and physical in the world is able to be one that we master and not lose by. And we go this year, not with our hands out, but with our heads tall and our chest back, proud. And we realize that the goal of this day is not to kiss up to some God who likes to torture us, but to connect to the God who's been loving us and giving to us our whole lives. And when we clear that filter, we shape our beliefs, and it shapes our reality. Thank you so much.